She signed on to work as a kindergarten teacher. It was one of the happiest times in her life.
It was nice being a fat with girls, and I loved that. It was great. Laughed my head off there.
But life was about to get complicated. Just after she turned 18, Diana met Prince Charles again at a friend's house. This time, the prince, now 30, and under great pressure to find a proper wife, took a more active interest in her.
Her breeding was perfect. Her status was perfect. He went out with all sorts of very glamorous and sophisticated women. And here was a woman, a girl, who was very fresh and naive and sweet and funny. And she flattered him.
They began dating, and after 2 months, Charles invited Diana to join him for Scotland's Braemar Games. It would be her first royal event. She would stay at Balmoral Castle, an official residence of the Queen.
Yeah, that was terrifying. Well, I mean, I never stayed in Balmoral before. We wanted to get it right.
That visit to Balmoral was a milestone for another reason. It's where the paparazzi first picked up the scent. Her life would never again be her own. The press began to follow her everywhere, even spying on her through her apartment windows.
People did not understand. They had binoculars on me the whole time. They hired the opposite flat, looked into my bedroom. I cried like a baby in the four walls. I just couldn't cope with it.
But the reporters refused to back off.
Any announcements of your marriage in the near future, can you tell me?
They knew Diana was the one. She knew it too.
I'm not going to say anything.
Right, but Prince Charles did give us a hint himself. He said we wouldn't have to wait too long.
On Friday, February 6th, 1981, after 7 months of courtship, Prince Charles invited Diana to Windsor Castle. He told her he had something to ask.
So he said, will you marry me? And I laughed. I remember thinking, you know, this is a joke. So I said, yeah, okay. And laughed. And he was deadly serious. He said, you do realize this one day you'll be queen? And a voice said to me inside, you won't be queen, but you'll have a tough role. So I thought to myself, okay. So I said yes.
The night before the official announcement, Diana said goodbye to her flatmates.
Champagne flew pretty quick.
And moved in with the royal family to start preparing for the wedding. A door closed on her old life forever.
I left my flat the last time, and suddenly I had a policeman. And my policeman the night before the engagement had said to me, I just want you to know that this is your last night ever and the rest of your life, so make the most of it. And it's like a sword went in my...
But she was all smiles the next day, February 24, 1981, as the couple announced their engagement from Buckingham Palace.
First, sum up how you feel today, both of you.
And proclaim their love for each other.
That's sort of weird, isn't it?
Really? Sort of.
Just delighted and happy. And I'm amazed that she's been brave enough to take me on. And I suppose in love?
Of course.
Whatever in love means.
Whatever did he mean by that?
Prince Charles has always been too honest for his own good. He does...
No one. She just returned from a 3-week trip to Australia, where she hadn't spoken to her new fiancé months.
Must have been an agonizing 3 weeks. Did you speak? I mean, the phone lines must have been pretty busy between here and Australia.
Yes, we tried. But it was quite difficult, because I think there was a certain amount of press interest there. Although they never actually found you, did they?
No. It was a complete disaster, because I pined for him, but he never rang me up.
I said, can I speak? And they said, no, we're not taking any calls. So I said, well, is the Prince of Wales speaking? How do I know it's the Prince of Wales? Came back with a reply.
I come back from Australia. Someone knocked on my door with a bunch of flowers. And I knew that they hadn't come from Charles because there was no note. It was just somebody being very tactful in the office.
What's more, as the world became obsessed with the new royal couple, Diana suspected Charles was obsessed with another woman. Camilla Parker Bowles, a former lover of the prince, was married to one of his close friends. But Diana still noticed sparks between them.
I once heard him on the telephone in his bath, on his hand, and saying, whatever happens, I'll always love you. And I told him I'd listened at the door. We had a filthy row.
When reporters saw Diana cry as Charles left for an official trip, they thought she was missing him already. But the secret tapes reveal her heart was aching about something else.
That was nothing to do with him going. The most awful thing had happened before we went. I was in his study talking to him about his trip. The telephone rang, it was Camilla. So I thought, shall I be nice or shall I just sit here? So I thought I'd be nice, so I left them to it and just broke my heart there.
Diana's anxiety began to show in a more troubling way. In 5 months, she lost 5.5 inches from her waist, and not just to look good in her wedding dress.
Bulimia started the week after we got engaged. My husband put his hand on my waistline and said, oh, a bit chubby here, aren't we? And that triggered off something in me. And I remember the first time I made myself sick, I was so thrilled because I thought, right, this is the release, the tension.
The disease would plague her for years. She had an episode of bulimia the night before her wedding. After she found a bracelet, Charles was giving Camilla.
There is bunting going up all over London, and there are pictures of the royal couple in just about every shop window in town.
I remember the Camilla thing, so I was desperate.
Some people are already staking out seats along
the road. I ate everything I could possibly find, and I was sick as a parrot that night, and it was such an indication of what was going on.
Any woman in Diana's position might have called the whole thing off, but there were more than two people in this relationship. There were millions. She saw no way out. Her sisters tried to raise her spirits.
I said, I can't marry him. I can't do this. This is absolutely unbelievable. And they were wonderful. They said, well, bad luck, Dutch. Your face is on the tea towel, so you're too late to chicken out.
Ladies and gentlemen, the mother and father of the bridegroom. Queen Elizabeth, His Royal Highness, the Prince of Wales, Prince Charles, heir to the throne of England.
And here comes the bride.
On the morning of July 29th, 1981, with trumpets blaring and a worldwide audience of more than 700 million savoring every detail, Diana emerged from her glass carriage feeling like she was going to an execution.
I was very, very deathly calm, deathly calm. I felt as though I was a lamb to the slaughter. And I knew it, but I couldn't do anything about it.
It was all pomp and spectacle.
I thought the whole thing was hysterical, getting married, in the sense that it was just like, it was so grown up. And here was Diana, a kindergarten teacher, and the whole thing was ridiculous.
There were 2,500 guests in the cathedral that morning. Diana was keenly aware of one.
As I walked up the aisle, I was looking for her. Spotted Camilla, pale grey, pillbox hat, saw it all to this day, you know, vivid memory. And I thought, well, there we are, that's it, let's hope that's all over with.
Desperate for a happy ending, Diana decided to focus on the positive. She was very much in love with Charles. Maybe now, she thought, he'd be in love with her, too.
I couldn't take my eyes off him. I just absolutely... I was the luckiest girl in the world, and you know, he was going to look after me. Well, was I wrong on that assumption?
So let's talk about how everybody who's anybody is having something done. Why don't they just stay home? Introducing a new clinical...
To get ugly.
You wanted to work.
To work, not to become a phenomenon!
You used to have a wife.
I can't even remember how I got here.
Behind the Camera, Charlie's Angels, an NBC movie event, Monday 9, 8 Central.
After their wedding, the royal couple set out for Buckingham Palace. 1 million people, by some estimates, turned out to show their excitement for Diana. The new princess was awestruck.
Got out on the balcony, overwhelming what we saw. So humble, making all these thousands and thousands of people happy. It was just wonderful.
Former palace spokesman Dickie Arbiter remembered the single moment the crowd had been waiting for.
It was almost a chant from the crowd, kiss her, kiss her. And they did kiss on the balcony. Never been done before. But they did, and there was a tremendous roar from the crowd.
But even in those first hours, those who knew Diana best were already worried about her future.
It was an optimistic time, but I can also remember a sense of just wondering how she'd manage in the system, and I think that was a shared feeling by many of us.
Their wedding night was to be their first intimate night together. Diana said only that it was strange, very strange. They spent part of their honeymoon on the royal yacht, Britannia, but romance hardly filled the air. For their private diversion, Charles brought the works of a South African philosopher.
I just had tremendous hope in me, which was slashed by day two. My husband took 8 Lawrence Van der Post novels along on our honeymoon. Well, no, to read. So every lunchtime or dinner time, when we were allowed to be on our own, we were supposed to read them. But we were never on our own. And I remember crying my heart out on my honeymoon. I was so tired. For all the wrong reasons. Totally.
Her husband's choice of reading material was the least of her worries.
We were opening our diaries to discuss various things. Out comes 2 pictures of Camilla. And on our honeymoon, we have a white tie dinner for President Sadat. Cufflinks arrive on his wrists. 2 C's entwined, like the Chanel C.
Oh, right.
Got it in one. Knew exactly. So I said, Camilla gave you those, didn't he? He said, yes. So what's wrong? They're a present from a friend. And boy, did we have a row. Jealousy. Total. Dirty.
Even on her honeymoon, the new princess could not escape Camilla's shadow.
My dreams were appalling at night. I dreamt of Camilla the whole time. And the bulimia was appalling, absolutely appalling. It was rife. It was 4 times a day on the yacht. Anything I could find, I would gobble up and be sick 2 minutes later. Very tired. 1 minute one would be happy, the next minute one would be blubbing one's eyes out.
How are you enjoying married life?
Highly recommend.
Diana kept her troubles hidden from the public. Her admirers clung to the image of the kindergarten teacher plucked from obscurity by a handsome prince, who took her off to a castle to live happily ever after. But Diana struggled to find her footing.
So that first week was such a traumatic week for me. I learned to be royal in 1 week. I was thrown into the deep end. Nobody ever helped me at all. They'd be there to criticize, but they'd never be there to say, well done.
Diana fell back on what she knew best, to be herself. She had the common touch that could bridge the gap between the palace and the people. The public responded to her. It would be a long time before Diana understood why.
People say to me, thank you for bringing happiness into my life. Thank you for coming. Thank you for making the effort. Thank you for being you. All those things I never used to believe.
Engaging the public is one thing. Coping with the media, quite another. They demanded more and more. Ken Lennox made a career out of photographing Diana.
Everything she did, every time she breathed in or out, they took a photograph.
The whole world were focusing on me every day. I was in front of the papers, and I thought this was just so appalling. I hadn't actually done anything specific like climb Everest or done something wonderful like that.
In November of 1981, the palace announced that the princess was pregnant. Diana's struggle with her health proved doubly difficult.
Sick the whole time, bulimia and morning sickness. People tried to put me on pills to stop me being sick. I refused to take the responsibility that if the child appeared handicapped, I wasn't going to take responsibility.
To make matters worse, the news that she was expecting only drove the press corps into a greater frenzy. Photographers were determined to get a picture of the pregnant Diana. Nothing seemed off limits. Lennox and his tabloid competitors followed Diana and Charles on their vacation to a very private island in the Bahamas. Using a very long lens, Lennox snapped pictures of a pregnant princess in a bikini. She was distraught.
I was horrified because I'd never walked around looking like that in a bikini.
The Queen called it the blackest day in the history of British journalism.
Overstepped a line, yeah. Oh, totally overstepped a line by the standards of that time.
Long after the episode, Lennox asked the princess whether she was prepared to spend the rest of her life coping with the press. Her answer was telling in its naivete.
She said, oh, Mr. Lennox, Prince Andrew will get married and I'll be forgotten about. And there'll be a new woman on the scene. And I said, I don't think that's going to be the case.
In truth, Diana would be hounded by the press for the rest of her life.
I'd have had a very bad time with the press because they'd literally haunted me and hunted me.
Haunted and hunted, Diana struggled to cope with feelings the press would know nothing about, but which would shape the rest of her life and their coverage of it. When we return, Princess Diana reveals her secret torment.
Thank you.
From outside the palace gates, spring 1982 appeared idyllic as the royal couple awaited their first child. But by now, little in Diana's life was as it appeared. The media interest in the impending birth was intense, so much so that Diana couldn't handle the pressure and wanted labor to be induced. But she recalled, it was difficult to schedule a birth date around the father-to-be's polo matches.
When we had William, we had to find a date in the diary that suited him and his polo. William had to be induced because I couldn't handle the pressure any longer. It was becoming unbearable. It was as if everybody was monitoring every day for me. Anyway, the boy arrived. Great excitement, thrills. Everyone was absolutely on high as a kite. We found a day that Charles could get off his polo pony for me to give birth. So that was very nice. I felt very grateful about that.
As Britain celebrated its new heir,
he's in marvellous form.
Diana retreated into depression.
Came home, and then postnatal depressions hit me hard. And it wasn't so much the baby that had produced it, it was the baby that triggered off all else that was going on in my mind. Boy, was I troubled.
And it turns out that Britain's royal family, which already has a little prince, is due for a royal addition in late September.
On February 14th, 1984, Valentine's Day, Diana's second pregnancy was announced. It came as something of a surprise for Diana because by then, she said, Charles was back in the arms of Camilla.
By then, I knew he'd gone back to his lady. But somehow we managed to have Harry.
Nonetheless, Diana recalled that pregnancy as the happiest time of her married life.
We were very, very close to each other 6 weeks before Harry was born, the closest we've ever, ever been and ever will have been.
Their closeness was short-lived, she said, because Charles had been hoping for a girl.
And then suddenly, as Harry was born, it just went bang, our marriage. The whole thing went down the drain. And Charles, all he wanted was a girl.
What's more, Diana said Charles was horrified at Prince Harry's red hair, a distinctive Spencer family trait.
First comment was, oh God, it's a boy. Second comment, oh, and he's even got red hair. So something inside me closed off.
But the couple kept up appearances. As in this 1985 British TV documentary called The Prince and Princess of Wales Talking Personally, in which Diana continued to play the role of the ideal royal consort.
I feel my role is supporting my husband.
She even had a cheery explanation for her weight loss.
Maybe I'm so scrawny, it's because I take so much exercise. Don't know.
But the truth was the talk of the palace. Diana said the Queen herself spread the stories Charles told about her.
He definitely told her about my bulimia, and she told everybody that was the reason why our marriage had cracked up, because Diana's eating. Must be so difficult for Charles.
Despite their joint public appearances in the late 80s, Charles and Diana lived separate lives. Diana took solo trips abroad and related to people in a way no royal had ever done before, bringing comfort to lepers and AIDS patients.
And this particular man was so ill, he started crying and I sat on his bed and held my hand. So I thought, right, Diana, do it. Go on, just do it. So I gave him an enormous hug and it was just so touching because he clung to me and cried and it was wonderful. It made him laugh.
It was a time of cruel contradiction for Diana. On the outside, adoring crowds and exciting work, while on the inside, she was isolated, depressed, and more desperate than ever.
I've got what my mother's got. However bloody you're feeling, you can put on the most amazing show of happiness.
What had happened during the 1980s was a parallel universe. That the world had lived in the fairy tale, Diana had lived in the nightmare, and she felt utterly powerless inside this system.
Powerless and bitterly jealous of Camilla, especially after Charles apparently stopped sleeping with his wife altogether after their 1987 royal trip to Portugal.
Shop closed up very quickly after Portugal, and that was it. And whether that meant that Camilla would come back in a big vengeance, I have no idea. I have no proof.
She talked about Camilla a great deal. in one or two of the lighter discussions about Camilla, as she would say herself, you know, what she found difficult to understand is how on earth she was losing out to a girl who had, you know, bad teeth and smoking and had dandruff.
Convinced she'd been cast aside by her husband for his old flame, in the mid-1980s, Diana herself turned to others for affection. In July 1986, Diana met James Hewitt at a party. She arranged for Hewitt to give her riding lessons and more.
Hewitt, to give him his due, helps to give her a sense of self-esteem, and it's the first proper relationship she has with a man roughly her own age.
Hewitt would not be her only lover. And while Diana railed against her husband's paramour in these tapes, she never mentioned her own extramarital affairs at all. Ken Wharf, who was Diana's bodyguard at the time, says the princess was open with him about her love life, but still clearly wanted Charles back.
I don't think she used it as a closing on her marriage. I think it was a statement. I think it was a statement saying, well, look, you know, if you can do this, so can I. And I think it was a protest.
While the palace seemed prepared to continue the charade of a happy royal household, Diana's friends said she refused to spend the rest of her life living a lie.
A large number of people around Diana saw her going fairly steeply downhill. They all knew what was going on. It was hardly going to remain a secret for long.
In fact, a climax was fast approaching. Diana was about to reveal her secret anguish to the world. Diana recorded 5 hours of audio tapes with her friend, Dr. James Coldhurst. So there are many more revelations to come when we conclude our special 1 week from tonight. In addition to the audio tapes, we have another worldwide exclusive, private videotapes that offer a rare and candid glimpse of Diana inside her Kensington Palace home. Stay tuned. We'll have a preview of next week's show coming up after this.
We begin the program tonight with Andrew Morton, the journalist and author of the 1992 international bestseller Diana, Her True Story. A revised version of that book, titled Diana, Her True Story in Her Own Words, was issued shortly after her death in 1997. It included edited transcripts of audio tapes she'd done in cooperation with Mr. Morton, who's our guest in the first half hour tonight. The other panelists will join us later. Tell me the history of this.
Well, I was writing a biography of Diana, and we had a mutual friend, a chap called James Coldhurst. And at the time that I was writing the book about her, I believed in the fairy tale that Diana was perfectly happy and everything was in the garden was rosy. He was telling me a different story. And Diana herself suggested, would I like to interview her? Well, I didn't need any second chance. And so I sent her a few questions in. I couldn't go to Kensington Palace and ask her the questions because
Why? It
was all very secret, all very hush-hush. And the powers that be would not have allowed it. And so James Coulter, this old Etonian friend of hers, he would cycle to Kensington Palace, have a cup of tea with her, sit her down, and in her drawing room, in her sitting room, she'd put on a microphone and she'd answer the questions that I'd given
her. Now, were some audio and some video?
No, it was all just tapes.
All just audio tapes, right?
Yeah. There are videotapes that she made with her voice coach in 1993, a chap called Peter Settlin.
Why are we just getting them now?
Well, NBC decided to do a documentary on how the book came about, and they approached me, and I said, well, that's what a good idea, because nobody's really done a documentary about the significance of Diana, Her True Story, in Diana's life. Because in the 1980s, she was just seen as this kind of cardboard, cut-out, two-dimensional character. After the book came out, people saw her as a more of a three-dimensional person, as a real human being. And for her, it was a kind of a passport to a new life. And so it was a seminal book at a seminal part of her life.
The documentary is Princess Diana, The Secret Tapes, excerpts from the NBC documentary. We'll air some of them coming up right now. Here, let's listen as Diana talks about her reaction when Charles proposed.
So he said, will you marry me? And I laughed. I remember thinking, you know, this is a joke. So I said, yeah, okay, and laughed. And he was deadly serious. He said, you do mean one day, you do realise this one day you'll be queen? And a voice said to me inside, you won't be queen, but you'll have a tough role. So I thought to myself, okay, so I said yes.
You know what's interesting is she had been a good interview.
She was a great interview.
Expansive,
because
great voice.
The great thing about her, the first tapes, intriguingly, it was like listening to a prisoner smuggling out her voice from, you know, from inside her cell. She kind of galloped through every aspect of her life, and it was almost like, here's the tape, and then I've smuggled the tape out, now please tell my story to the world. That's what she felt. She felt trapped inside this loveless marriage, trapped inside this institution, and she saw the book as a kind of a conduit to let her have a voice.
She was very glad to have this book come out then.
Oh, I mean, one of the funny things was, as soon as she gave the interview, she said, right, will the book be out in a few days then? You know, this is how naive she was. She just thought that I could just knock a book out in a matter of days. And it took a year, because what we decided early on is that she needed to have deniability, so that when the Queen, when Prince Philip, when Prince Charles said to her, did you cooperate with Andrew Morton, she could look them in the eye and say, no, I never met him. So we used Coulthurst, James Coulthurst, this mutual friend, as the go-between, and he was, as you were, the deep throat.
Yeah.
And there was a time.
The beard,
where, yeah. I mean, there was a time where we were due to meet. We were going to have dinner together, and I was waiting. It was at James's house, and a paparazzi photographer was waiting outside, so we had to cancel it. So that was how dangerous it was, because all the time she was followed by the paparazzi. She had a police bodyguard with her, and in a way it was like for her living in an open prison.
Where's James now?
Well, I spoke to him about an hour ago. He was at work.
Let's hear another tape. Here Diana talks about her bulimia, which she was already suffering from during their honeymoon on the royal yacht. Listen.
By then the bulimia was appalling, absolutely appalling. It was rife. It was four times a day on the yacht. You know, anything I could find, I would gobble up and be sick 2 minutes later. Very tired. So of course the mood slightly got the mood swings going, in the sense of 1 minute one would be happy, the next minute one would be blubbing one's eyes out.
Why did she want to talk about that?
I think she wanted to give people a sense of how despairing she'd been inside that royal system, and how that in a way she'd not been given the time and the care that she felt that she needed. Here she was, 1 minute a kindergarten teacher, the next minute a media superstar, and it was just too much for her to handle. She was only 20 years old. People forget this. She was so young, so naive, and she needed that kind of time. And people were bowing and scraping towards her, you know, as soon as she married inside the royal family. But inside she was dying, and she didn't like this image that was being presented of her as being the fairy tale princess, when she knew the real story. The new real story was that her husband was basically in love with another man's wife. That's what killed her.
How did she hook up with you? Why Andrew Morton?
Well, I'd been writing about the royal family for a number of years, and I met Diana on a number of occasions. It was always kind of bright, light and trite, but we had mutual friends in common, and the most significant one was this chap, James Coulthurst. And at the time, in 1991, she was just at the end of her tether, and she just wanted to tell her story. And it was so naive. She said, well, would he like an interview? As though I would say no. And so that's how it began. And it wasn't just like a one-off. It went on for a year. And it wasn't just like it was a question of making these secret tapes. She would be on the phone to James all the time, six or seven times a day, eight times a day, with asking for advice, talking about what was in the papers. I remember he was writing speeches for her. We were almost like a shadow court. I mean, on one occasion, she was in a restaurant. She rang up and said, "Oh, the speech that you've written, you've got to cut it down." So we ended up in a pub having a pint of beer, writing this speech out. It's so amateurish and so ramshackle, but it was very, very effective.
Was she neurotic?
Well, I think I'm not a psychologist, but she was terribly worried about being put into an institution by the royal family. She'd been threatened as such. She was
really
there was all kinds of whispering from inside the circle of Prince Charles, saying that she was a cracked vessel, that she was unstable, and she knew very well, in a way that nobody else did, that ultimately the control of her children rested with the Queen, not with her, with her mother-in-law. And that was a significant thing. She was one of the most powerless people in Britain. She didn't have the control over her own children.
We'll take a break and come back, hear more tapes. The panel joins us at the bottom of the hour. Andrew Morton's our guest. Don't go away. memory serves me correct, when your book came out in 92, didn't the palace go crazy?
I mean, not just the palace. I mean, everybody went crazy. I mean, and even today, people kind of say, well, was it true?
Angry
was
at you? Or?
Furious, yes. I mean, I remember members of parliament said that I should be thrown in the Tower of London and they should throw the keys away. And,
because?
Because they said it was untrue, that I was destroying the fairy tale, I was destroying the myth. And
but you had the tapes.
But I couldn't say that she was behind it. I was actually, I felt like a fairground boxer, you know, where you say, I'll take on all comers. And I had one hand tied behind my back because I couldn't say that Diana was behind this. And so it was a curious thing because this was like an authorised biography. She actually read every chapter before it went to press.
Yet denial had to occur after.
And so I had to give her what you Americans would call wiggle room. So that
she
could kind of maneuver herself inside the royal family, and it worked very effectively.
That had to be weird for you.
It was, yeah. It made the burden a lot tougher. But ultimately, when she made her own TV program on Panorama in 1995, she basically confirmed everything that was in the book. So that was a great vindication.
On this next portion of the tape, we learn from Diana how Camilla cast a shadow over the honeymoon and of her jealousy.
We were opening our diaries to discuss various things. Out comes two pictures of Camilla. And on our honeymoon, we have a white tie dinner for President Sadat. Cufflinks arrive on his wrist. Two C's entwined, like the Chanel C.
Oh, right.
Got it in one. Knew exactly. So I said, Camilla gave you those, didn't he? He said, yes. So what's wrong? They're present from a friend. And boy, did we have a row. Jealousy. Total. Dirty.
Was she in love with Charles?
Absolutely, absolutely besotted with him. And as she walked down the aisle at St. Paul's Cathedral, she felt, you know, she saw Camilla Parker Bowles and she thought, I hope that whole episode is over. And she had, as she said to me, you know, hope and love brimmed in my heart. So she was in love with him. And remember, she came from a broken home. She felt that by marrying the future king, she could never divorce, that the pain and anguish that she felt as a child would be assuaged by moving into this model family, the royal family that stand as an emblem for home, heart, and security. And she found within days that it was all just make believe.
How do you feel about her?
I have to say, I admire her more now than I did when she was alive, because I realised as I've got older just how courageous she was in doing what she did, not just in talking to me, but by the courage it took to go through the separation and then firstly single-handed to reinvent herself as being from being a princess of Wales, really, to being a princess for the world, so that she was on this humanitarian mission. She could have been just, you know, a cover girl and a glamour girl and on rich men's yachts, which, of course, was an image that was painted when she was with Dodi Fayed. But at the same time, she knew that she had a mission in life. She knew that she had a destiny and had a profound sense of destiny. And we've heard an indication of that in the tapes. And I think that she stuck to that.
What do you make of her lover writing a book and going forward?
Well, I mean, James Hewitt, the butler, the detective, the private secretary, they've all come out with their memoirs. Mm-hmm. And this is what happens when you're a major public figure. Diana was one of the most significant figures of the last century.
So this should be expected.
And it seems to me that biographically you always get memoirs, be it from family, friends, confidants, whoever. And then you get biographies where it's an objective outsider tries to make sense of that life. So it seems to me entirely appropriate.
The butler got racked up, but his book was laudatory about her, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think Paul Burrell, who you had on your show a few months ago, he's a kind of a royal zealot. He paints himself at the centre of things where he's not really there. And for me, one of the disappointing things about his book is that it's a kind of a mishmash of exaggeration and hearsay and make-believe.
On this tape, Diana talks about her self-doubts and lack of self-esteem.
I hated myself so much. I didn't think I was good enough. I thought that I wasn't good enough for Charles. I wasn't good enough for Mother. I mean, doubts as long as one's leg, but,
It's hard to believe that someone as attractive as that, bright, funny, mm-hmm. would have that kind of feeling about herself.
Yeah, she, when you actually listen to the full tapes, you get a sense of a woman who's very self-deprecating, yeah, but doesn't have a very high opinion of herself. And that was one of the enduring problems of her life. She would read an article in the newspaper, and it would hurt her. It would, if it was a negative article, it would because she had very low sense of self-esteem. And she was always fighting that battle to give herself a sense of who she truly was.
You think she was sorry the book came out?
Well, obviously, in the first few days, with the furore it happened, I mean, everybody was sorry when the book came out, and it was a tough old time. But then the letters came in. Thousands of letters came to Kensington Palace, and similarly, after she made her panorama programme, from women, mainly women, around the world, who had seen something in Diana, in her admission, in her conversations, in who she was, something of themselves. And so many women came forward about their bulimia, about their eating disorder. So there was a step change in public perception of that, and it's now far more acceptable, it's more discussed, and I think that she's helped around the world hundreds of thousands of women with that, and she was very pleased with that.
So you think in long range she did not regret it?
No, absolutely. In the first few days, obviously, because it was so tumultuous, but afterwards, not at all.
Where have these tapes been?
Well, they've been in a plastic bag.
In your possession?
No, they're not my tapes. I don't own these tapes. Everybody thinks that they're mine, but they're not. They're owned by my publisher. And they've been in a...
Who is the publisher of the book?
Michael O'Mara Books. Mm-hmm. And they've been in a safety deposit box.
Why now?
Well, it could have been any broadcaster. It could have been CNN, it could have been NBC, it could have been ABC. It happened to be NBC said, look, we'd like to do a documentary about how you did the book, because we found it a fascinating story. Because
12 years later.
Yeah, 12 years later. It takes the news guys a long time to work these things out. And I said, yeah, fine, let's
do it. NBC paid the publisher, paid you?
Well, NBC paid the publisher for the tapes, yeah. And I gave them an interview about how I did the book. But it was in many respects... CNN could have done it. ABC could have done it.
You've written a few books since, right? You wrote the coal miner's book, right?
Did that book on those Pennsylvania miners, 9 for 9 last year.
Madonna,
Monica Lewinsky. We've sat here and talked about
that.
Monica. Yeah, young Monica. So I mean, Diana has obviously been an integral part of my life, but not the only part of my life.
I'm going to ask you, and the panel will join us after the next segment. We'll be right back with more of Andrew Morton. Don't go away. In this segment, last audio tape we'll hear is Diana talking about the reasons she tried to harm herself. Listen.
I was just so desperate. I knew what was wrong with me. But nobody else around me understood me. I needed rest and, you know, to be looked after inside my house and for people to understand the torment and the anguish going on in my head.
But it was basically a cry for help.
Desperate cry for help, and I'm not spoilt. I just need to be allowed to adapt to my new position.
I know you're not a doctor, Andrew Morton, but how did this happen to her, do you think?
She was literally overwhelmed. She'd gone from nowhere, from being this kindergarten teacher, just enjoying practical jokes with James Colthurst. I mean, on one occasion she covered his car with eggs and flour and just messed about, just like a kid, just a school kid. And then, within a matter of months, people were bowing to her, people were curtsying to her, people were looking at everything she wore, analysing everything, and she thought she was going to get help from inside the royal family. But she got nothing, and it's one of the what we know now about the royal family is that they're not very warm people. I mean, you know, when Prince Charles wants to talk to the Queen, he sends her a memo. So that's the way they work, and that's the way they operate. She didn't get any of that, so she felt very isolated, very alone, and she felt utterly in despair.
How did you meet Charles?
She met Charles at her parents' house at Althorpe on a ploughed field when she was a 16-year-old. Then subsequently, she was at a barbecue, and it was just after Lord Mountbatten had been assassinated. And she was very sympathetic towards him. And he was, as she would say, all over him. He was all over her, like a bad rash. And that's how the romance started. And do you know that, Larry, people say to me, well, Dodie Fayed was just a fling, because she was only with him for just a few days. And when I look at the romance with Charles and Diana, it was a very short romance. They really started dating in August 1980, and by February 1981, he'd asked her to marry him in the nursery at Windsor Castle, which I think is very symbolic, because she was too immature and he was probably too immature, and he was being pushed into marriage by his parents, by the public, to marry a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. And for me, the legacy for Diana is the fact that, thank goodness, William and Harry will be able to marry who they want.
They will, won't they?
I think so. And you've seen that with Prince Edward, that he's been able to marry who he wants.
Would she have married Dodi Fayed, do you think?
The jury's out on that. I think that he...
The butler says no.
Remember, Paul Burrell felt that he was going to lose his job because Dodie had a butler. So, he was the first boyfriend that she'd ever shown in public. She'd been out with him in Paris, in Saint-Tropez. All the other ones were hiding in the backs of cars, blankets over their heads. And so, in a way, she was pushing back the boundaries. Would it have lasted... Probably a bit longer, actually. She felt very safe and very secure with him. Just what she wanted with Prince Charles. Safety and security.
Charles
never got
marry Camilla?
Good question. I think the status quo will exist for some time to come.
Because?
Because the
They've
constant...
loved each other
because
for a
the
long
constant,
time.
Well, I think they should get married, quite frankly. But I think the consternation in the church and in the palace... and certainly amongst the Queen supporters, would be such that it would irrevocably split the royal family. Because after all, he's going to be a defender of the faith, and so on and so forth. So I think that in terms of his heart, he should end up marrying Camilla. In terms of the constitution, it could create something of a schism.
Did the hierarchy, the family, ever come to love Diana?
I think that Margaret, Princess Margaret, who was her next-door neighbour, was quite a fan, because they shared the same kind of metropolitan interests, ballet and so on. But after the separation, blood stuck with blood, and she was out. And they knew that she was dismissive of them, and they were equally dismissive of her.
Fergie was her friend, though.
Fergie was a friend, but in and out. Diana's friends were very much in and out. She was, as somebody said, very tidal. And one minute you could be in, one minute you could be out. Fergie, she fell out with over her autobiography, where she made some remarks about she got verrucas from Diana's shoes. And Diana never really forgave her for that.
She was very sensitive then.
Diana tended to compartmentalise her friendships. She tended to not trust anybody. Because after all, for most of her life, she'd been conspired against. Not just by Prince Charles and Camilla, but by the courtiers, by the police, by the valets and so on. So that she never really trusted anybody. So she put them in compartments. And if she felt that you had gone over the line, then she would dismiss you.
You like her?
I have enormous respect for her. I liked her a lot. I think she was a vibrant spirit. I think that she was a great sense of humour. And she's a great loss, not just to the world as a beautiful young woman in the full bloom of life, but also for humanitarian causes that she supported.
Why does the interest in her remain so high?
Because she's an icon. Because she tells us something about ourselves. When people knew that when she died, people responded to her because they saw in her loss their own loss. And I think that was, in a way, her profound effect that she'd had on the world, that they saw her journey from 1992 onwards, this woman struggling to come to terms with the demons inside herself, and also with the family, and I think she was going forward. She was making the best of herself.
In retrospect, anything you would have liked to have asked you didn't?
I think I'd like to have explored face-to-face more of her relationship with the Queen and with Prince Philip and other members of the royal family. But remember, at the time, I was still in the thrall of this. I still thought, remember, you know, I still believe in the fairy tale. And how far can you go with a princess? What can you really ask? And remember, it was always once removed. I was asking her questions and somebody else was saying, well, OK, tell me how many times you tried to commit suicide. Well, let's go on to the next time. Do you remember so-and-so? So it was, I mean... I asked her about her suicide attempts, just for example, and, you know, I was very kind of nervous about putting those questions down. And after she answered them, she said, well, Andrew's pretty well written my obituary then, hasn't he? So she didn't really, she never really took herself too seriously.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Robert Lacey, Kitty Kelly, and Hugo Vickers. Don't go away. Family, the real story of the Bush dynasty, scheduled for publication by Doubleday later this year. And in London, Hugo Vickers, best-selling biographer, veteran royal watcher. His current book is The Unexpurgated Beaton, the Cecil Beaton Diaries as he wrote them. Let's start with Robert Lacey. What do you make of these tapes, Robert?
Well, of course, we've read them, as Andrew said, in the second edition of Andrew's book that came out after Diana's death. In a way, of course, we read them the very first time in the book as mediated through Andrew's words. And I have to say that although I was one of those who was shocked and outraged by what Andrew did in the early 90s, I've come to see that, as he suggested, my rage, and I'll confess it now, was misplaced. I mean, the rage we have to feel, if we feel rage about the book, is actually at Diana. Andrew's repeated the incredible system of deception which she worked out in order to sabotage the royal family, fight her battle. I myself don't criticize Andrew at all for what he did as a journalist in making that possible. I think historians will thank him for it. And I found what he said tonight fascinating because he has revealed some interesting aspects about Diana, which I think raise certain questions. This question, for example, of her lack of self-esteem. Here she is in her tapes all the time talking about her lack of self-esteem. And we've always thought, well, this is because of the rotten royal family. When you listen to what Andrew's just said and think about the tapes, you say, well, wouldn't this woman have had a problem in any family? You hear about her bulimia. Well, didn't she suffer from the bulimia before she got involved with the royal family? The unkind royal family didn't understand. But Andrew himself has said nobody in the 1980s understood about bulimia. So all right, I welcome this program. I welcome the evidence.
Does he have a good point, Andrew?
Well, thank you for those points, Robert. But I mean, let me just show you the pictures. You look at the pictures of Diana before she married and the pictures of her after she married, which I put in the book deliberately to show this thing that Diana was slightly plump, slightly overweight before she married, and then within a matter of months she'd lost several stones in weight.
Doesn't Robert have a point? Something had to be wrong intrinsically. Now, the marriage may have excavated it, but something had to be wrong there to begin with.
It is ludicrous to think that Diana did not have problems before she married Prince Charles. After all, her parents had gone through an acrimonious divorce. Her sister Sarah McCorkadale, she'd suffered from anorexia nervosa, so it was something that was in the family. Her mother herself has said that she's suffered from
the combination
slightly wobbly feelings when it comes to eating food. So yes, but the trigger was going into that family, and if she'd gone into a different family, I don't think she would have suffered quite the same. It was because of that sense of isolation that really was the one that triggered it.
Kitty Kelly, it's quite different hearing her say them than reading them, right? When you hear the voice.
That's true. It is. You know, Larry, I think the thing that makes this so fascinating is that Diana's story is the story of a majority of young women today. It's a very modern female story, and I think it's probably hard for men to identify as much as women. Women out there who are pretty are chasing after an ideal that is, you can't be thin enough, you can't be pretty enough, you can't be rich enough. And Diana seemed to have it all, and yet she really didn't. And I think this is what makes her story so gripping, especially to women. And making these tapes was a huge gamble for her. She really just threw the dice and wanted to see what would happen.
This is, in a sense, Andrew, a Greek tragedy.
Absolutely. I agree with everything Kitty said, because she was actually effectively putting a marling spike through the bottom of her boat when she spoke to me.
Yeah.
She didn't know me. I mean, I wasn't a great friend of hers. She was handing hours of her innermost thoughts to me. I could have gone out from day one and put them on and just produced them on a TV show or whatever.
Yeah.
But Larry, will this be shown in Britain?
Andrew.
Will these tapes be?
I've no idea. It may not. I don't know. I know there's a lot of interest from British media to
Doesn't
NBC.
Doesn't NBC have the worldwide rights?
Yeah. Well, yes, it'll be down
so
to NBC.
They can show them in Britain or sell them to Sky
they
or
can
BBC.
Do whatever they want. Yeah, it's their documentary, obviously.
Hugo, what are your thoughts on what we've heard?
Well, I'm rather saddened by the whole thing. I'm sad that these things are coming out now, because they don't tell us anything new, I don't think. I don't blame Andrew Morton for doing it, because I think that the Princess of Wales had many, many good qualities. I was a great fan of hers, but she was very manipulative, and in a sense she was manipulating him. She was using him as her way of telling her story. I don't believe that it was a passport to a new life. I think in the end it was a passport to disaster. And I do think that she actually did regret it, and she certainly regretted the Panorama interview later on. I would like to take him up on a couple of points. He talks about Prince Philip not having been sympathetic at all. Well, we know a certain amount about these letters that Prince Philip wrote. Well, I've acted to the Princess of Wales. I actually read these letters, and if you'd read those letters, you cannot suggest that he was not trying to do anything possible to help her. And at the same time, he gave her the benefit of the doubt that she hadn't helped him, because that's what she told him. And secondly, just a small point, but Princess Margaret once told me that after the separation, she went to Prince Charles and said, "I've always been a great friend of hers, and I hope you won't mind if I continue to be so." And he immediately said, "No, absolutely, I completely understand." So those are two particular points I wanted to make.
Want to respond?
Yes, well, certainly with the Prince Philip letters, people have said that, Hugo's right, that they were very vicious in tone. But I remember, they were. He wrote those letters because of the book. And I remember, and I'll tell you this, Diana phoned and asked for advice on who, on a lawyer to speak to, so that she could respond to those letters. That's how agitated she was at the time. That's how concerned she was at the time. And she contacted a mutual friend who contacted me and asked me for that advice at that time. So, just to put the historical record straight, that's the specifics. He's quite right about Princess Margaret. They're quite good friends all the way through to the separation. And then after the Panorama programme, then the drawbridge came down.
We'll be right back with Andrew Morton, Robert Lacey, Kitty Kelly, and Hugo Vickers on this special edition of Larry King Live. Don't go away. Robert Lacey, assuming they get to hear it and see it, what do you think the effect will be on the two boys?
I think that they will, perhaps this is surprising, be much happier to hear their own mother's voice through Andrew Morton's tape recorder than they will to hear what Paul Burrell says that their mother has said. These boys are, you know, we talk about them as boys, we like to think of them as boys, they're men. They're men who've grown up in a pretty tough school of life, and they're used to the media. They absolutely despise the media, of course. They're absolutely convinced that it was the media that chased their mother into that tunnel. So I should have thought that there won't be the shock horror we might expect.
Agree, Andrew?
I think he's absolutely right. I mean, they are young men now, and at the same time, they've heard their mother talking on Panorama about the fact that Prince Charles should never become king, that she had a lover, James Hewitt.
Their father.
And they've seen their father saying that he had an affair with Camilla Parker Bowles, that he was forced into marriage. So they've gone through all this. So, you know, that trauma for them is over and done with. They've moved on.
Kitty, how well did she do with those boys up to the time of her death?
Oh, I think that she was an absolutely magnificent mother. from everything we've seen, everything we know. She seems to be loving and nurturing. I'm curious to know, you know, the pictures show that, yes, she was in the throes of bulimia. It's a dangerous, dangerous disease. But at the end of her life, when she was working out, going to the health club, she looked so vibrant and healthy, like she'd really conquered it. And yet we're told by Burrell that she hadn't conquered it at all. And he says that he went to great lengths to help her. He encouraged her in her bulimia. But she seems to have been on top of it.
Andrew?
Kitty is absolutely right. She was on top of it. And you look at the pictures of her in 82, when she, just after she'd married, and how gaunt she looked. Then you look at her in 1996, 97. She was sleek, sophisticated. The whole way that she held herself was quite superb. And she was at her most vibrant, at her healthiest towards the end of her life. And at her most confident, meeting people like Colin Powell, Henry Kissinger, and Larry King. And
She met me in Poland, same night.
Absolutely, and rubbing shoulders with you in a way that she would never have done a decade before. So I would totally disagree with Hugo Vickers. As far as I was concerned, she became a new person. She really came into herself as soon as she separated from Prince Charles.
Hugo, you can comment on that and also tell us why you think the fascination with her remains.
Well, I think, just to begin with, the fascination remains, because, as Andrew Morton has said earlier on, I mean, she is an icon. It's like Marilyn Monroe, all these different characters. People will always be interested in her. But I'm sorry, I think that towards the end, she was really spiraling into a very dangerous sort of chaos. I don't think she knew really what she was doing or where she was going. One minute she was indeed on a rich man's yacht. The next minute she was worried about what the press were saying, and so she rushed off to do something for the Red Cross. She actually asked the Red Cross if she could come out with that. She was so obsessed with newspapers. She was telling stories to the press. She was very manipulative. And, I mean, maybe I'm old-fashioned, but, you know, there she was. She was the mother of these two boys. One of them is going to be King of England one day. Should she not have considered this a little bit more? I mean, Andrew, I think, seems to think that the royal family are kind of a whole group of monsters, and perhaps he feels they should be got rid of altogether and that they shouldn't be there anymore. But I'm sorry, you know, she was very bad in the way that she reacted to the very unfortunate and, I agree, very difficult situation in which she found herself.
Andrew?
Well, I think it's an absurd proposition. Diana did her... I think she was very amateurish about her manipulation because she tended to do it herself. Prince Charles employed a number of people to do his spin doctoring for him. And he often... And after her death, he wasn't spin doctoring against Diana anymore. He was spin doctoring against the Queen. So manipulation inside the royal family is part and parcel of where they've been. As far as Diana's concerned, the humanitarian mission that she was on with Landmines genuinely spoke to her as a human being, and she was really into it. But she realised two things, that her position and her beauty and her iconography could be used to do good, and that's why she used the mass media to that effect. At the same time, she didn't want them intruding into what she considered to be her private life. But obviously, with my book and with a Panorama interview and so on, people thought that, well, she'd crossed a line.
Robert Lacey, how's that? Is that inquest in progress concerning the death?
Yes, we've seen photographs, newsreels here of the coroner, who's actually the British coroner, has gone over to Paris, made a point of having himself photographed in the tunnel with the French police. They're making a big point of the fact that now the delay was caused by the delay in the production of the French documents, and the delay seems to be down to the fires. But I don't think it'll be until next year that we actually get results from this.
We'll be right back with Andrew Morton, Robert Lacey, Kitty Kelly, and Hugo Vickers on this special edition of Larry King Live. Don't go away.
My husband made me feel so inadequate.